Good afternoon and welcome to Employees with Disabilities, Recruitment, Hiring, and Training. This is the second webinar in a two-part series introducing the Demand-Side Employment Project Toolkit and Resources. The first webinar, Inclusive Culture in the Workplace, was recorded and archived on the project website. My name is William Myhill. I am the Director of Legal Research and Writing for the Burton Platt Institute at Syracuse University, and I'm the Project Director for the Demand-Side Employment Placement Models Grant, funded by the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. I'll be serving as the moderator for today's session. This webinar will explore innovative strategies to successfully recruit, hire, and train people with disabilities. An inclusive culture values all employees' individual differences and needs. Likewise, the key to generating qualified, productive, and loyal employees with disabilities requires a commitment to making all aspects of the employment process open, flexible, and accessible. Our panelists will explore these strategies and the resources in detail. Our objectives for today are to learn about the importance of accessibility in the recruitment, hiring, and training of employees with disabilities, to identify the people central to and the resources available for an effective recruitment strategy, to understand the role of vocational services in the hiring and training of employees, and to identify best practices in the recruitment, hiring, and training of employees with disabilities. Today's guest speakers are Dr. Mira Aja, Jill Houghton, and Gary Shaheen. Mira Aja is the BBI Director of Research, whereby she oversees the research agenda across all BBI offices. Her interdisciplinary research focuses on identifying and remediating social problems through empirical exploration of the factors that affect decision-making and testing of remedies that fit within an existing research framework. Jill Houghton is the Organization Development Specialist at BBI. She is working with Fortune 500 companies to recruit, hire, and promote employees with disabilities by building partnerships with state vocational rehabilitation agencies and employment service providers. Additionally, she is leading an effort to develop and implement the Diversity Disability Supplier Program. Gary Shaheen is the Senior Vice President of the Burton Blood Institute. He is a nationally recognized expert in the field of mental health rehabilitation, homelessness, and systems change. He has provided his expertise as a trainer and technical assistance resource to state mental health authorities throughout the country. Gary teaches a course on inclusive entrepreneurship in the Whitman School of Management at Syracuse University. Before we get started, I want to share some information and answer some frequently asked questions that we've received about our webinars. Today's webinar is being conducted using Blackboard Collaborate, a web conferencing system that is fully accessible to everybody regardless of ability and/or the assistive technology that might be used. This system makes it possible to conduct workshops over the internet from just about any computer with an internet connection and web browser. Participants also are able to listen to this session using a phone connection for audio. If you are using the phone connection, please put your phone on mute. Additionally, this session is being captioned. To turn on captioning, please select the CC icon in the upper toolbar to open a separate window with captioning. Today's session is also being recorded and archived for future use. You will be sent a link to the archive after the session. A recording of the first webinar, Inclusive Culture in the Workplace, also is available. I'll point it out to you towards the end of our presentation today. At this time, we are unable to troubleshoot any individual technical issues. We do recommend that you close all other applications you are running on your computer because they may interfere with your successful experience today. Also, periodically tap the space bar just to let the webinar system know that you are still there. Participants may submit questions at any point during the webinar by typing them into the chat area in the bottom left of the screen. Questions will be addressed at appropriate times throughout the session and during an open forum at the end of today's presentation. We will now begin panel discussion. Our first guest is Mira Aja. Mira, are you there, and would you give us a brief introduction?
Absolutely. Can everyone hear me? Someone give me a green check to make sure my audio is working well. Wonderful. Thank you. So William, you already introduced me well. I'm the Director of Research here at the Burton Blatt Institute. I'm happy to discuss the issues that are on the agenda today and excited to do so. As you know, we've done research here at the Burton Blatt Institute conducting case studies with large Fortune 100 and 500 organizations, looking at their inclusive culture, their practices, and understanding how that impacts the recruitment, hiring, and training of individuals with disabilities, as well as downstream along the employment spectrum, the accommodation, the promotion, the retention, and the advancement of individuals with disabilities as well. And while I'll definitely keep it focused on recruitment, hiring, and training, I think this is an area that really sets up the stage for the employment experience across the board for one's employees and has relevance to that. So I'll pay homage to those issues a little bit too.
Thanks very much, Mira. So to get us started, how does accessibility in the recruitment, hiring, and training of employees with disabilities affect a business's bottom line?
I think across the board, it has significant capacity to affect the bottom line of an organization. And really the most obvious way in which that takes place is when you don't have an accessible recruiting process and you aren't able to bring in the best candidate, you're missing out on the talent and the value that exists within the potential workforce and not turning them into a realization for your actual workforce. This way, the leading candidate can go on to become employed at a competitor, but across the board, they just won't be a part of your organization. If someone is able to overcome the barriers to the accessibility challenges that exist at the stage of recruitment and hiring, they have still entered the company understanding that there is a lack of accessibility here for them, and they're likely not to be as disclosing about their disability as they continue through their employment experience. And as they're individually trying to manage that, that might cause some other impacts along the way. It doesn't allow them to reach their full potential. One of the things that, of course, we've paid attention to in our prior webinars and that I think will continue to have relevance here is that many of the things that we can do to be accessible and inclusive at all stages of the employment process, but including at the hiring and training side of things, is that there's a universal component to it. If you implement a solution for one group of individuals, it tends to work for multiple groups of individuals, and it definitely lends an atmosphere to the workplace of inclusion and a positive culture that can affect things.
Thank you. That's very insightful. It is common sense, I think, to many of us who work in this field, and yet it's so important for employers to become aware of these issues and how it can really help their bottom line. Tell us a bit more then. What are the elements of targeted recruitment activities with regards to employees with disabilities?
Sure. Well, I think across the board, you just want to make sure that there are no barriers in any stages of the process. So as you look at your hiring and recruitment processes, you can think about all the different pieces that go into it. You're crafting your job description and you're listing all of the skills, the certifications, the added value components that someone can bring to the workplace. You're advertising it in a certain manner. You are promoting certain aspects of your business in a tiny little blurb. Why would someone want to come work for you or move to a different community and come work for your organization? In all pieces, you can examine what it is that you're communicating and how you're making opportunities available and make sure that they wouldn't inadvertently pose any barriers and that they communicate that your organization is one that's committed to inclusion and that's committed to diversity. In our past webinar when we discussed culture at large, we noted the importance that a diversity statement that explicitly articulates all of the different groups that are included in your organization can have great value and set a real tone. In the advertising of a job position, that is one place where you can start to make that communication to the public and say, this is a company that has these values. We welcome applicants from all of these different targeted groups. look at the way in which you're posting that and what groups it's likely to reach. In addition to going to your usual suspects, your job boards, or your pipelines, think about specific targeted pipelines that may be more likely to reach individuals with disabilities, other professional networking sites, professional organizations, vocational rehabilitation pipelines. So all across the board, I would say, in terms of the method that you use and in terms of the substance and the information that you're putting out, there are multiple opportunities to make sure that you are accessible and to make sure that you are inclusive. Moving a little bit further down the chain, when someone sees the advertisement and determines that they are eligible for the particular employment opportunity that you're advertising, how is it that they're able to then apply for that job or communicate to your organization that they want to be considered? Most sites these days, most companies are moving to online mechanisms, and as we'll discuss a little bit ahead, the online systems need to be accessible fully and completely throughout the process, and they can be tested by users, they can be tested by the company, and there are technical guidelines that can support us to make sure that inadvertently we're not having that system screen out or pose any barriers.
Great, that's an excellent segue into an area of research I know that you're undertaking with regards to these types of web portals. What then is the role of an employer's web portal with regard to recruitment and hiring?
Yes, we're fortunate to be working with a professor at Towson University who has great expertise and has been evaluating online systems for a variety of different entities and determining whether or not from a user experience perspective they meet accessibility sort of standards, if you will. So there's certainly, there are the World Wide Web content accessibility guidelines that are available and posted for everyone to examine and make sure that all of their online systems meet usability and accessibility standards. There's also Section 508 that dictates web accessibility guidelines and standards that should be met. These are available in the public domain, and they should be accessed, and your IT department in your company should be conversant because all your web portals should meet these standards, but absolutely we would say your recruitment, your online hiring systems should. The other thing you can do is you can have individuals try to test the system and access it, and this is what we're working on in our research with the professor from Towson University. We've had him go into the online hiring systems of 16 different companies with 16 co-researchers who are individuals who are blind and have screen readers and are able to work online as long as the online system that they're interfacing with has been designed in a way to be accessible. These 16 individuals applied for two jobs each, so we had 32 applications and tests of whether the system would work and be accessible. And out of 32 of these attempts, only 9 of them were able to be conducted in a way where there were no problems and they could function independently and submit an application. And that's a 28% success rate. So across the board, he has done this research with, for example, with airline ticketing systems when you purchase tickets online, and he's found similar results. There are many systems that are just designed in a standard routine way using general best practices, but they can inadvertently set up small systems that are barriers. You can't press a button, you can't get a preview, you can't upload using a screen reader, and these are all of the key components of being able to submit your resume and make sure you have a successful application. But fortunately, the way to overcome this is really simple, and it just involves digging into these additional accessibility guidelines and making sure that all your systems are compatible with screen readers. In fact, the next phase of our research, which I would hope to report on in the future, will involve conducting case studies with companies where we can do the evaluation of their system and then work with them to improve it and document what the steps were that were necessary so very common issues can be documented and the common solutions implemented. If anybody today who is listening would want to learn more about this or participate, I'd be more than welcome to contact me, and I'll type in my email address so that you can reach out to me, and we'll be excited for that collaboration.
Thank you very much, Kara. We'll go ahead and move on to our next speaker, but if you have questions for Mira or for other speakers, you're welcome to put them into the text box, and we will hold those until we get to our question and answer, or possibly we can answer them on the spot, depending upon where it is in our sequence of the panelists. So please go ahead and type in any questions you may have, and we'll move to our next panelist, Jill Houghton. Jill, would you like to just check in and say an introduction, please?
Thanks, William. Well, I think that you introduced me in the beginning, and I do work on the Southeast Taste Project, and I also serve as the Executive Director of the U.S. Business Leadership Network. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Great. Thank you very much, Jill. I'm glad you mentioned that. So as we move along in this discussion of hiring and recruitment, training and advancement issues for people with disabilities, and harking back a bit to our last webinar where we talked about different roles of persons in the employment culture and how they can play a role in being supportive or posing barriers to whether or not people with disabilities have these opportunities. What can you tell us about the roles that management personnel have when in facilitating either the effective hiring and training opportunities, or that is both the effective hiring and training opportunities for employees with disabilities?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we talked about on the last webinar is really key to point out again, which is that from a management standpoint, that you know, it's one thing for management to support and be a champion of diversity. It's another thing for them to kind of move beyond that and to be a champion of inclusion. Because diversity is something that exists regardless, but inclusion is something that you have to make a conscious decision that you're going to create. And so in terms of the roles that management play in facilitating the effective hiring and training for individuals with disabilities, A, they have to be really committed towards creating an inclusive culture and get that message out loud and clear. So, you know, some of the things that they need to champion and drive throughout the company are things like making accessibility a priority. So, you know, not just thinking about it from the axis of like how does the applicant get in the front door, right? But thinking about it holistically in terms of the workplace. So whether that's looking at it through a universal design lens and looking at the universal design and the access of things, where things are on shelves, like if they need to access the copy paper in the copy room, or, you know, thinking about doors to bathrooms, thinking about the physical side of it, but also thinking about the ergonomic side of it as our workplace changes and as folks perhaps are beginning to telecommute and work in hoteling environments, et cetera, thinking about it from an ergonomics and a health and wellness standpoint and factoring in disability and thinking about being inclusive, as well as looking at it from a technology standpoint. So through their online application to how an employee accesses the intranet to perhaps how an employee accesses, perhaps they do training videos, right, on their intranet, and maybe the employee is a person with deafness, looking at, you know, are things captioned. So really looking holistically at those three legs of the stool and making sure that it's a priority and that they're they're championing an inclusive environment. And then, you know, something that we all talk about is, you know, it's one thing for management to be that champion. Then pushing down that information and getting those mid-level managers invested and bought in and making sure that they have the knowledge that they need so that, for example, if somebody does request an accommodation, that they know the process. But that, you know, instead of just pointing fingers at, well, like, that's not my job, or, gosh, I don't know whose budget that comes out of, so they don't know what to do, but really empowering those mid-level managers with training and with information. You know, focusing on just creating that environment where there's an opportunity for open dialogue between management and between individuals with disabilities, and management should include people with disabilities. So that's kind of a holistic viewpoint, William.
Thank you, Jill. That's excellent. Looking at the big picture then, and at how companies, how they're evolving today, one of the trends that seems to be evolving is for peer mentoring and affinity groups to be developing in companies that sort of serve to meet different interests or needs in the company. Are these types of things also taking place for people with disabilities in the workforce?
You know, absolutely. I think that what we've learned and what we're learning in this space is that many companies are beginning to start, perhaps they have an affinity group, or perhaps they're looking at starting one. They're called a lot of different things. Sometimes they call them an affinity group. Sometimes they call them an employee resource group. And more recently, we're starting to hear about companies calling them business resource groups. But absolutely, I think that the groups for women, perhaps for minorities, perhaps for the LGBT community have been further developed. But absolutely, corporate America have ERGs that are alive and well and doing a lot of great work in terms of supporting employees with disabilities. I think that in our space, to begin with, they were kind of created to create awareness within companies and to create an opportunity to be supportive of employees, to create a place where people can share information with each other, perhaps find somebody that they can talk to about their particular disability or their particular situation, talk about situations that they've encountered and how they've overcome them. I think that business is starting to, you know, need to look at these groups from a bottom line perspective and wanting to use these groups to reach new markets. So through disability employee resource groups, use them to help them reach the disability market, to help them develop new products and services, to help the company come up with the next big idea that's going to impact the bottom line. You know, they can also use these employee resource groups as an effective recruitment tool to bring them qualified job applicants with disabilities into their organization. And certainly for those companies that are federal contractors and that are looking at these proposed 503 regulatory proposed rules that are out there, I think that a lot of businesses are starting to look at their ERGs and talk with their employee resource groups about how they may work with them to be that effective recruitment tool to help them find candidates.
Oh, great. Thank you very much, Jill. I didn't realize that there was such a background to these types of affinity groups and that they are taking on these different roles. So tell us then, what sources do you recommend for effective hiring and training of employees with disabilities?
Well, there's lots of sources out there. A couple that I would highlight is the U.S. Business Leadership Network works closely with EARN, which stands for the Employer Assistance and Resource Network, which is funded by the U.S. Department of Labor, the Office of Disability Employment Policy, and Cornell University runs the EARN program. It's a resource for employers who are seeking to recruit, hire, and retain qualified employees with disabilities, and you can find out more information through their website, which is www.askearn.org. So that's certainly one resource. Another resource that we work closely with is through the National Employment Team, which is essentially each state has a vocational rehabilitation agency that's there to help people with disabilities go to work, and that's there to assist business in getting direct access to a pool of qualified applicants. And the National Employment Team has a point of contact within each of those agencies. And a woman by the name of Kathy West Evans leads the National Employment Team. And I would strongly recommend, I know a lot of businesses that have worked very closely with, they call themselves the NET, and that have worked closely with the NET. Kathy can be reached at 206-999-9455 and is an incredible resource to help business navigate all those myriad of agencies. And then, of course, the folks at the Job Accommodation Network, I think we talked about them on the last webinar, and they are an incredible resource at the Job Accommodation Network. They, too, are a project that's funded by the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Disability Employment Policy through West Virginia University, and their website is askjan.org. Lou Orsaline runs the Job Accommodation Network and is an incredible resource. And then there's a lot of additional resources out there, folks like Centers for Independent Living, the workforce system, obviously. So, I mean, would always encourage business to get out there and talk with folks and find the right partner, because who works with one partner in one community may not be a good partner in another community. So you've got to get out there and find what works best to meet your needs. And certainly the resources that I've just mentioned, I know many businesses have worked closely with and had great success.
Thank you so much, Jill. We've put a few of those links into the text box for folks, the Ask EARN, the USBLN, and the Ask Jan. Jill, feel free to add other ones that you'd like to suggest are helpful. And we'll go ahead and turn now over to our colleague, Gary Shaheen. Gary, would you like to just say hello and introduce yourself?
Okay. Thanks, William. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, just fine.
Okay, great. Hi, everybody. So I'm Gary Shaheen, and I work here at the Burton Blatt Institute, and primarily the work that I do is on implementing evidence-based promising practices, things like the supported employment, the customized employment, but increasingly here at BBI, we have been initiating projects to build collaborations and develop local, state, national partnerships around entrepreneurship. And while this call is concerned in most aspects about ways that employers can hire people into their businesses as wage earners, some of the other things that perhaps we'll get around to in the course of the call is how do employers also encourage through diversity contracting or other kind of mechanisms, development of products and services by entrepreneurs with disabilities, and what could providers do to support entrepreneurship. So as William indicated early on, we do a lot of training, a lot of technical assistance in all of those regards. So, William, over to you. I imagine you have some questions.
Thank you, Gary. And as time permits, I'd like to ask you some more about those particular things that you just mentioned. If you draw from your training experience, Gary, and different agencies and systems you've worked with and within, how do vocational services help employers hire and train qualified employees with disabilities?
Yeah, well, you know, both William, both Mira and Jill talked a little bit about this, and all I can do is piggyback on some of the things that they said, and that state vocational rehabilitation agencies are available throughout all states and into the territories, actually, and their purpose is to connect folks with diverse disabilities to jobs, and they often run business services programs. They do they conduct partnerships with business associations. They get the word out. But I think probably some of the most effective work of the vocational rehabilitation agencies has really been to make the case that there is really a business bottom line that could be achieved by hiring qualified folks with disabilities. And with their strong networks to employment programs in their communities and their networks to business, and the fact that the vocational rehabilitation agencies are also mandated partners in the Ticket to Work employment networks, it puts them right at the center of the game, if you would, between folks with disabilities who are job seekers and employers looking to hire and increase the diversity of their workforce. So those are among the capabilities of the VR system. To that, I'll add that the through the VR system, employers could take advantage of hiring incentives, things like the work opportunity tax credit that helps to pay a portion of a employee's wage, the workers with disabilities employment tax credit, WETC, that also helps to offset some of the wage costs, disabled access tax credits. So there are a number of these economic incentives that through VR agencies and their assistants, both employers can benefit from, and the job developers might be able to reference that. But along with that, I'm also going to offer a caveat. For the job developers out there, typically what we'd like to say is, you don't lead by these tax credits, by these kind of economic incentives, that, you know, the best selling point for individuals with disabilities who are actually self-representing them in a job search or for employment specialists is that we're making the best case that that individual is qualified for the job, able to produce and able to contribute to the employer's bottom line. And these tax credits and incentives really are sweeteners, if you would, for the employer to consider as they're making a hiring decision. So VR agencies can be very important, but it's also extremely important to understand what some of their limitations might be, because there is a time-limited nature to VR services, and they have, as many folks on the line know, what is termed a Status 26 closure requirement, and that's 90 days in job, that afterwards the VR counselor can not always, but really close that case. So they do have benchmarks to achieve. And, you know, like so many of the government systems these days, VR offices are stretched with limited resources. Folks have high numbers of individuals that they have to serve. They have to be an expert on all disabilities. Oftentimes, VR staff might need extra training to more effectively serve folks with perhaps more complex needs, folks with psychiatric disabilities, folks with co-occurring disorders, substance abuse, mental health issues, and folks transitioning out of homelessness, for instance, including many of the veterans that are coming back in now from current conflicts who have a variety of disabilities that need to be accommodated. So wrapping that all together, some VRs are very, very good at collaborating and partnering, and others might not be as good, just as the provider networks have that same type distinction, I suppose. So, William, I think that for folks out there, the employers, understanding who the VR agency is as a gateway to a source of workers could be an extremely important resource for employers.
Thank you, Gary. Appreciate you getting our discussion going with providing that kind of coverage of how our VR system can work for us in this way. We've had a discussion about diversity issues as well as that inclusivity, and Jill has helped us a great deal with understanding how we may look at diversity in the workforce. What can you tell us about the role of diversity policies, or diversity policy specifically regarding training and retention and advancement issues for employees with disabilities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the way I look at it, William, is that, and again, Mira and Jill got us started in this area, is that diversity training, diversity hiring just makes good bottom line sense. And I like to look at it as sort of the workplace equivalent of the curb cut, if you would. So we all know that, you know, curb cuts were put in place through the advocacy of the disability community to make life that much easier and improve accessibility for folks with disabilities, but we're all using them. And in the same way, effective hiring and retention strategies that accommodate in the workplace folks with disabilities are also just of great benefit to the general workforce. So if you look at the fundamental principles associated with diversity practices and why they also mean and make good human resource practices, you know, you come up with things like, you know, increased cooperation and respect and planning that puts in place clear lines of authority so that people understand what types of tasks are required of them, the kind of accommodations that increase productivity, workplace flexibility. All of those have meaning for folks who may not have a disability in the workplace. And so as employers reach out to folks with disabilities in a proactive way to increase their diversity in the workplace, I think it's a great opportunity for them to also look internally and say, so how have these diversity hiring, retention, operational, if you would, practices really helped us achieve a better bottom line in our business? And then what can we do to make sure that they're fully integrated and sustained within that business? The other part of diversity hiring and workplace diversity is that it sends a message. Sends a message to the buying public. You know, all of us who go to the grocery store, you know, and pick up that salad dressing, that Newman's Own salad dressing, and see the label that says a certain amount of this, the profits from this dressing go to charities, might be, you know, more inclined to perhaps buy that because that company is sending a message that they have a double bottom line. Their bottom line is not only selling me that salad dressing, but also contributing and giving back to the communities. So when employers have a visible, viable diversity hiring policy, they also send a message to their communities that they are not only looking to increase their financial bottom line, but they want to give back to the community. They want to diversify their workforce for all the purposes that we've all talked about, but that it just makes good community sense in a civil society to do that. So those are a few things that I can think of off the top of my head, William, that really contribute to employers looking at hiring and diversity as contributing to their bottom line. But, you know, Jill mentioned the EARN website, and the other day I got on that website and looked around that website to see if there were any examples that really cut to how do you actually quantify a accessibility, diversity policy in terms of a real return on investment, financial return on investment. So in fact, they actually had an interesting study there that, that folks may be interested in hearing. And there was a, it was actually happened in the UK, a financial services company that asked for some help in increasing their web accessibility capabilities. And just like I mentioned, the company came to this design agency and said, you know, we have a moral obligation to be inclusive. We want to look out and better tap the market, if you would, by folks with disabilities themselves who might want to buy our products and services. We want to position ourselves better with the with our competition. And we're very sensitive that increasingly we want to be good citizens. So they contracted with this design company, and they improved the accessibility of their website, and they had a good moral obligation to do this. But after that, they found that there were real financial returns on their investment. Some of these were that the take-up of some of the financial products they were offering via this site increased by 300%. So by using this new accessible website, 300% in new orders, their maintenance costs were reduced by 66%, their natural search capabilities were improved by 50%, customers themselves reported that the site was easier to navigate. And so you begin to see some of that curb cut analogy, if you would, that I mentioned. And the bottom line here is that when you diversify, when you make things accessible, you just have a great potential to improve the visibility and the viability of your business.
Thank you, Gary. So I'd like to turn a bit more then now towards an area that you have been working a great deal in the last few years, and that's the area of entrepreneurism. In particular, is that a viable option for people with disabilities?
Oh, absolutely. But here's the problem, William, is that oftentimes, even as we celebrate choice and individual choice, people are just never asked the question. Do you want to be employed in a wage-paying job, or do you want to work for them for yourself? And in fact, what we know of now is that many people value a career as a small business owner over wage employment. Many people might have operated or have worked in and gained the skills needed to start a small business at some point in their lives. Another fact about entrepreneurship that's valuable and what we hear from folks is that when you're a business owner, you have control over your economic future. They want to be the person in control. And it also can result in a perceptual change from the role of a person who might be a client or a program participant or consumer to somebody who is actually a small business owner on Main Street. So a little bit about how we've come to this. We, as you know, William, are one of three states that were given a U.S. Department of Labor grant a number of years ago to test and demonstrate models for entrepreneurship. And for that first year of development, we did not deliberately serve one person. Now that, of course, got us, you know, in a little bit of trouble with our federal partners, but they really knew where we were going, and they knew enough about our model to know that we would accelerate, and we certainly did. And the reason that we determined not to serve anybody is that we wanted to build, and all of our partners on this call have talked about this, a strong set of collaborations. We wanted to ensure that at the local level, we understood the economics, what consumers' needs and interests were. We wanted to bring VR to the table, the One Stop, the Small Business Development Center. We wanted to develop a consensus-driven model for entrepreneurship. So after that first year, we went into high gear, and we started serving folks. And by the end of the grant, we were supposed to have trained 150 people with diverse disabilities, by the way, in entrepreneurship, business planning, and so on, and started 30 small businesses. Well, by the end of that initial project, we had trained well over 225 people with diverse disabilities, helped to establish 60 small businesses, most of which are still going today, and the income per month is anywhere from a few hundred dollars to some thousands of dollars. And we implemented a class where my students actually are business consultants to these entrepreneurs. We generated individual development account, financial assistance, where individuals deposit $1,000 in a credit union and they get it matched, $1,000 for starting a business. We now have 61 of these people, these credit union individual development accounts going. It's the highest in the nation for folks with disabilities. So the long way around your question is this. If we offer individuals an opportunity for choice, it should also be offered that they may want to start their own business. And at that point, it's really pulling together the partners in the community, including the business entities that can help with business planning and so on, to make sure that folks get the right training, the right support. And we have plenty of publications on this. And we called it Startup New York in the beginning, and it's sort of morphed into something now that we've called Inclusive Entrepreneurship, because it involves a lot more than what the original grant had offered.
Well, thank you very much, Gary. That it's amazing to me, because I don't think we have much general knowledge of thinking of people with disabilities in this entrepreneurial fashion. And what you're telling us is about your work, where it's really showing that these are viable options for people with disabilities. Would you like to add a little something about your more specific work with veterans?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, here at Syracuse University, J.P. Morgan Chase recently created, through their endowment, a institute on veterans and military families. And we work very closely with them. Many folks on the line might have heard of the Entrepreneurship Boot Camp for Veterans with Disabilities. That was started here at Syracuse, and we were a partner in that project right from the beginning, actually using many of the methods for developing entrepreneurial awareness and early startup that we use with our Startup New York project, and introducing that to the veterans. So now there are 8 universities, and it continues to grow throughout the country, who are providing training and support to veterans with disabilities in starting their own business. Now, so while we partner with the Institute for Veterans and Military Families on this initiative, I also have to say that in entrepreneurship programs that we've started here in Syracuse, or that we have helped to replicate throughout New York State in a number of different locations, we are beginning to see veterans coming into those programs. Our Syracuse program has served veterans right from the beginning. And what tends to change for veterans is perhaps some of the mechanisms of support. In Startup New York, we integrated right from the beginning peer support meetings and monthly networking lunches and those types of things, so that people with disabilities who are entrepreneurs can network and share information. Well, with veterans, there's a very strong cohesion among the veterans community, so we've had to make sure that veterans have opportunities to network among themselves and help each other out as they start their business. But, you know, beyond that, it's still a lot of the same. It's developing, you know, good business planning training. It's working with your small business development center and your VA vocational rehabilitation, as well as your local vocational rehabilitation, and finding financing. And if there's any lessons we learn, and William, this goes for veterans as well as for folks who are not, is that we tend to focus so much on the business plan. And I'm not going to say that the business plan is not important, but it is not the first thing in the process. We have found over time that the first thing in the process is for folks to develop a very informed self-employment choice, and to test that, and to do the research, and develop their own team to assist them, and fully identify the pros and the cons and the market viability, so that before you develop a business plan, whether it's a veteran or not, what you want to develop is a good self-employment goal that is fully informed, that builds upon your strengths and your interests and your skills and identifies the market potential. And then a business feasibility. Will this business have market viability as well as personal viability? And frankly, state departments of vocational rehabilitation can often provide funding through the individual employment plan for self-employment, and they're going to rely on a well-thought-out plan and feasibility to make a determination. So business plans, you have to keep revisiting them constantly. And whether or not you're a veteran or a non-veteran, many of these same things hold true. But we continue to do this work at BBI, assisting veterans throughout the country, and entrepreneurship is one of our key training and technical assistance offerings.
Well, thank you again, Gary. That's fantastic, and thank you for sharing that information with us. We have some time to take some questions from participants in the audience. And while we wait for folks to type in questions, I will just take us around to a couple of the resources that we have available on the project website. So I've brought up the main page to the project that provides an introduction to our webinar today. And I believe if I go to the Learn More section, then we can find a link on here to where we can view the Inclusive Culture and the Workplace Archive webinar from the last webinar. You can click that to watch that particular webinar. And at the top, if you click on the Employer Resources, we've mentioned these short briefs in the past, but I want to point out a couple of additional resources that we have down here at the bottom as we begin to populate this toolkit more. The very last item is the Workforce Development Resources, State and Federal Funding Opportunities for Employer. This is a comprehensive list of different size grant funds available from state and federal entities to help private businesses hire people, sometimes specifically with disabilities, and in other cases just to hire persons for their workforce. These are available to a wide variety of businesses, and we keep this particular resource up to date, so take a look at this, and perhaps you'll find some funds on here that could support your hiring of a person with a disability to help increase the capacity of your workforce. All right, backing up to where we've come from, we don't have a question right yet. So what I'll do is I'd like to pass this back to our panelists to see if you have any particular comments you'd like to add to this discussion, or if there are any things you'd like to more specifically reiterate that you've talked about that you feel are particularly of importance for this topic. Give you a moment, and Mira, why don't I pass it back to you if there are any things you'd like to bring out or highlight for us before we finish today.
Thanks, William. I think I covered the key aspects both across the past webinar and this webinar. Nothing really significant to add, but happy to take some questions. If I had to reiterate a point, I would just say that it's really important to make sure that you look at your processes seamlessly from beginning to end and consider all aspects, both in terms of the methods that you're using when you recruit folks and when you're working with them, as well as the communications that you're making when you describe your company or describe the opportunities, both in the print medium or the online medium, as well as in your interactions.
Thank you, Mira. And panelists, we do have a question from Michael Glisson. It reads, we have started a business in which we exclusively hire those on the autism spectrum to serve customers. It is a coffee shop setting. We want to change the face of autism. Do you have any specific resources that can help?
Oh, maybe I'll take that one, William.
Please, go ahead.
Yeah, this is great. Actually, one of the entrepreneurs that my students worked with in the first semester was a young man with low spectrum autism. And what we found were a number of things. First of all, you have to deal with the business metrics. It's not only employing folks, but you know, what's the economic viability of that coffee shop over time? How do you diversify your market? Do you have financial accounting procedures and all those other types of things? So with all that business stuff aside, the other thing is, you know, let's make sure that we allow folks to negotiate, to navigate, to work within that setting to the best of their ability using whatever accommodations might be necessary. So for instance, a great example of that was the student team that I supervised that worked with that young gentleman I mentioned. One of them was an engineering student, and as part of their deliverables, they have to provide deliverables to the entrepreneur. The engineering student took on redesigning that workplace so that he can better negotiate his tasks in his furniture manufacturing business and also have a better way of managing orders. So I think we can change the face of autism just like we can change the face of so many other disabilities, and self-employment, working in an enterprise is one way to do that. But feel free to send us an email and look at our website, our BDI website, go to Startup New York, and you'll see a lot of information about what we're doing in that area.
Thank you, Gary. I've taken us to the homepage of BDI, and if you go to staff on our page, you can find links to contact any of us who are on this particular panel right now.
Mm-hmm.
While we're waiting on any other comments, Jill, can I pass it back to you if there are any things you'd like to reiterate or bring up that you feel we've missed out on?
The one thing that I would just add is that I touched on this on the last webinar in the very end, but Gary, in talking about inclusive entrepreneurship, I think it's important from the corporate side that if you are a business, that we are working with corporate America to be inclusive of disability-owned businesses in your supplier diversity program. So typically, business has been focused on including women and minority-owned businesses in their purchasing and procurement practices, and we have, the USPLN has a third-party independent certification for disability-owned businesses that is inclusive of service-disabled veterans. And you know, certification means nothing if it's just a piece of paper for a business to become certified. It comes to life as these businesses begin to get business. So one of the things that has to happen is as corporate America is rounding out their diversity and inclusive practices, to look at what are you doing around procurement and in your supplier diversity program to include service-disabled veterans and people with disabilities. And so you can find out more information about that program by visiting the USPLN.org website and learning more about the Disability Supplier Diversity Program, which is the new kid on the block, but someday it won't be.
That's great. Also, William, if you don't mind, maybe folks want to take a quick look at the BBI website under projects. There's the page for Startup New York and Inclusive Entrepreneurship. We've been talking about those terms, but there's a variety of resources available at our website that folks can download, toolkits and primers on the project and metrics that we use and so on.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you very much, Jill. And thank you, Mara, for your time and your insight and sharing your experiences both through the research and through the teaching and through the training. All fantastic work. Just a reminder to folks, you can come to the website and you can find the links for downloading the version to view the webinar from last time and this one. You'll receive an email link to the address that you use to register for this webinar in your mailbox. It will provide you a direct link to the archive of this particular webinar today. And take take your time to peruse the employer toolkit. We'll continue to populate that with more resources that we encourage you to try out and share with your colleagues. Thank you, everybody, for an excellent discussion today. And that's all we have.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you.